Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here, and today we'll be talking with you about producing more food for your household from your garden and some other things too with John Hendrickson, Senior Outreach Specialist with the Center for Integrated Agricultural Systems at UW-Madison. He directs the 2009 Wisconsin School for Beginning Market Growers, helping you get started in small-scale vegetable production and marketing if you want to do that. He has a three-day school. It'll be held Friday through Sunday, January 16, 17, and 18 on the UW-Madison campus. And there's still, John tells me, some spots available. So pleased to have him with us. And certainly if you have questions either about starting up your own business of that nature, or just questions about vegetables and growing, soil fertility, all kinds of things. John's got lots of experience. We're really pleased to have him with us. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. John, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
This is the 11th year of the Wisconsin School for Beginning Market Growers. And tell us first, and you've talked about this in the past, but for those who don't know, what's the school all about?
Well, we created the school to help people get started with a business growing and selling fresh produce, although the focus is on vegetables. Obviously, yeah. Fresh produce can span more than that. And we're actually toying with the idea of expanding our educational programmings to include fruit and berries and other products. And we have offered mm-hmm. schools on cut flowers in the past, too, although we're taking the year off on the flowers this year. But it's really designed to expose you to what you need to know to successfully grow and market fresh vegetables. It's a strong focus on organic production practices. The three grower instructors that I work with all follow organic farming practices, and the other strong focus we have is on direct marketing. And so we do a lot of talk about farmers markets and selling to local restaurants, mm-hmm. Community-supported agriculture, those types of arrangements.
Yeah, and you have your own small organic farm, do you not?
I do. My position with the university is part-time, mm-hmm. Although it could easily take up all my time, and the same is true for my small mm-hmm. farm as well. I grow organic vegetables and sell mostly to restaurants.
Very good. Well, Yvonne in Brown Deer has a question for you, so let's go right to Yvonne. Yvonne, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I would like for some not details, statistics on how fast this organic gardening thing is doing, how well it's doing, and where. I'm not finding much of it right around Milwaukee. I know there is, but I would like to be able to get a garden plot on the school grounds. I know that it's done in the Southwest a lot, and it's very good. I've seen articles in magazines about students who are involved in these vegetable gardens in grade school level, whatever, are doing much better as far as grades, other attitude towards school, and just it's a wonderful thing for children to get into.
Well, you know what? We're having a little problem here with our headphones. Suddenly, John's headphones quit, and I'm not quite sure what happened here. I'm going to kind of have to paraphrase a little bit until we can get this straightened out.
Mm-hmm.
So you're interested in go through this a little bit more again for me. I was distracted a little
gardening.
Bit. Community gardens. I was distracted myself because I was trying to help get this going for John. But you're interested in community gardens.
Yes. And this would be for grade schools or middle schools.
Okay.
I know that it's happening in a lot of other places. I don't know of anything of that happening here in our community.
Which is your community?
Well, around Milwaukee.
Okay. I'm not that familiar with the goings-on in Milwaukee either. I do know that there's quite a lot of community garden space here in Madison and of been hearing about community garden efforts popping up in other parts of the state. I would encourage you to contact.
We'd be wanting to focus on having them in the educational system, in the properties where the students can go out and be involved in gardening.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. So it's less a community garden than a school garden.
A school garden.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, somebody else, you know, John doesn't, you don't have any information on that, I take it, John.
Well, there are some school gardening efforts here in Madison that I don't know, remember the names of the schools per se, but if the person wanted to contact me.
We can look that up.
After the show, I'd be happy to track that information down for them.
Sure. And someone else may have who's listening may have some information on gardens like that that are set up with schools. And so certainly if you want to get back to us, Yvonne, we'll be glad to.
Who's going?
I'm sorry?
Is there an organization beyond?
Well, we're not sure about an organization. So I'll tell you what, get a hold of John Hendrickson after the show, and he can look some things up for you. And there may be some other people calling in with information. So stay listening, and we'll see what we can come up with.
Yeah, I definitely could put her in touch with some people that are involved in that in Madison. I just don't happen to know the names of the schools that are involved.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org, and we'll be happy to put you on the air. And some more callers coming up online here. But before we go back to the phones, I wanted to make sure that you deal with soil fertility, you deal with crop production, you deal with health and pest management. I mean, you really kind of
We really try to cover the gamut from taking care of your soils and getting them ready for growing to growing the plants, starting them in the greenhouse, setting up your irrigation system. Growing the plants out, transplanting, all the tools and equipment you need, the marketing end. We talk about the economics of it, how much you can expect to make from an acre of vegetables, how much labor that's going to take, those kinds of issues.
Well, Tom in Green Bay has a question for you, so let's go to Tom. Hello, Tom. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. Actually, I have some good news, and I don't know if you've heard that the 2008 Farm Bill, the big ag bill that was passed.
Yeah.
Includes a provision that now all of our public schools in America can preferentially buy their fresh fruits and vegetables from farmers and farmers' markets, the local farmers in the farmers' markets. In addition to that, they will grant $50 per student money for fresh fruit and vegetable snacks. In addition to that, any school with 50% or more of their students on a free lunch program, which is many of our schools, receives the funding for the market garden curriculum and the startup money to put those children out on land to grow food, to learn how to grow the food. And the money's all been released as of October, and the schools simply need to apply for it.
Well, that's great news. I don't know, John, you want to comment?
Well, that's actually not the only piece of good news with the newest version of the Farm Bill, although I'm not sure that all the money has been appropriated yet for all those programs. So I think there's still some work that needs to be done to make sure that those good programs are followed through on and that money is available. There's also going to be increased amount of funding available for beginning farmers, people wanting to get started in any kind of farming operation.
So that's good news. Thanks a lot, Tom, for reminding us about that. And that's in the 2008 Farm Bill. Crystal in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Crystal.
Hello. How are you today?
Great. Thank you for calling.
Great. I was just calling to respond to the earlier woman asking about community gardens in Milwaukee for the school children.
Yes.
And I volunteer at what's called the Urban Ecology Center. And what we do is we help to educate the urban school kids on the outdoors and things of that nature. And we do have some community garden plots as well. So I'm thinking if she contacted the Urban Ecology Center, it's right on Park Street, New Holland Park Street, right near Oakland Avenue. We could definitely get her involved in some of those kinds of programs.
Oh, sounds wonderful. Crystal, thank you.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
Yeah, you too. The Urban Ecology Center. So we've got
I've met some of the people from that organization. They do great work there. Another organization in Milwaukee that might be worth contacting is Growing Power. Will Allen started that many years ago, and they do tremendous work working with not only just the Milwaukee community, but actually across the country, helping urban agriculture projects get started.
And, you know, our daughter, Emily, is five. She's in kindergarten in the Montessori school, and our Montessori doesn't have much in the way of a garden, but there are other Montessori schools around the state, including in Milwaukee and so forth, that do have those kinds of gardens, and she should check with the Montessori schools. That's another place where she could check. 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org, zeroing in today on vegetables a bit with our guest John Hendrickson, and also talking about the beginning the Wisconsin School for Beginning Market Growers. Really pleased to have him with us. And maybe you're thinking about starting up your own little market deal, or maybe you're just a vegetable gardener or want to get into it and have some questions along those lines. Certainly, John can answer a lot of questions for you. John, I'm wondering, on vegetable varieties, do you talk about vegetable varieties and new varieties and things like that in the school?
Well, we do. Given the number of different types of vegetable crops that you can grow, you know, from asparagus to zucchini, there's really not any way for us to go in depth on all crops and all varieties. So what we do in our 3 days is when we talk about crop production, we ask our grower instructors to focus in on two crops each. So we cover six crops in depth in the class. And certainly variety selection is part of that conversation. And there's also certainly opportunities for people to ask questions and have conversations about their favorite varieties throughout the whole 3 days.
Yeah, I'm sure. And so that they pick those beforehand, or do you?
We pick those beforehand. So the growers come prepared to talk in depth. You know, they say we're going to pick tomatoes to talk about, and we'll carry that conversation from selecting the varieties through selling them. How do you set your price and all the way through?
Okay, what are you picking this year, or haven't you picked yet?
We have picked. The question is, am I going to remember off the top of my head here today in front of the microphone? We're going to be talking about tomatoes for sure this year. We're going to be talking about lettuce and salad mix. We are going to do garlic. I believe we're going to do potatoes. And I think the other one we're doing is winter squash.
Winter squash.
Is that six?
Sounds like six.
I wasn't counting them up as I went.
All right. There you have it. Meg in Madison, we go to you now. Hi, Meg.
Hi. I'm calling about container gardening. We have a small yard and a couple of dogs, and I was wondering what the best vegetables to grow in containers were, mostly the most prolific ones, the best producing.
Yeah.
Well, traditionally, what most people put in containers when they are in a situation like you without space is tomatoes. It's obviously one of the most popular crops to grow. Everyone likes a fresh tomato. And they can be grown quite successfully in containers. There are some excellent resources, both book resources that you might access in your library, as well as resources online that can give you probably better advice than I can give you, because I personally have not done container gardening.
You know, we had a show not long ago about vegetable growing, and a woman called to say that she had a kind of a barrel, you know, a barrel that she planted a potato plant in.
Yes.
And started with not a lot of soil, and then as the plant grew, kept adding soil to the top. And she said she was amazed at the amount of potatoes she got out of that.
Yes,
situation.
That's an excellent point. There are people that call those potato towers. And I heard them, one person describe doing that in tires, and they kept adding tires as the potato crop grew. I'm not sure that I would necessarily recommend growing in a tire, because I'm not sure what the what might be going on there in terms of contaminating your soil with growing in tires, but it's certainly one option.
Yeah, and actually that came up on the show too. Someone else called in and said tires, and actually then the guest commented that, well, the tires would hold the heat in and probably do a good job that way. But there could be some other issues on the other side of things too. So there's tomatoes and potatoes are a couple for you there.
Yeah,
man.
And you know, another comment I would make is a lot of this, given that there's a growing interest in container gardening, some seed catalogs will actually specify as you know, what particular varieties are better suited for container growing than others. I believe the Johnny's Selected Seed Catalog is one that does that.
I think Jung's does too. I think Jung's might as well. So there you have it, Meg. Good luck. Thank you for calling. Sharon and Shatek, we're on to you next. Hi, Sharon.
Good morning. The second time you guys have talked about this, and Bob Tomish, not Tomash, thank you. Bob Tomish talked about it, but he's too young too. Ruth Stout, years ago, wrote a book about how to have a green thumb without an aching back.
Yeah.
And she used mulch for everything.
Yep.
Never plowed a foot. And she always grew her potatoes on top of the ground. And this would be really easy for kids. You won't be able to teach them how to heal them up, but it's the same principle. You put them on the ground and cover them up with hay. And when the little plants come up through the hay, you cover them up with some more hay, and they'll keep coming. They'll never have to dig the potatoes. And for new potatoes, you just reach underneath the mulch and get some new ones on the 4th of July or whenever it is you want them, and then you just let them continue to grow.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I was actually going to bring that up and just...
It's an old book. I don't know if it's out of print, but it's really a wonderful thing to read and know about.
Yeah, the book is excellent. And there are even I know small-scale market gardeners that actually follow that method of doing the mulch with our potatoes rather than digging them. The thing that you have to make sure of is that you're adding enough mulch so that those potatoes really are in the dark.
Right,
otherwise
that's true.
Otherwise you have the greening. And
you're also saving gas because you're not running a rototiller between your rows.
Yeah, well, yeah, and there's a great old film that I've mentioned in the past about Ruth Stout. Ruth is in the book, and she goes about the business of planting her potatoes, and it's really quite entertaining. I wish I had a copy of that film.
It is an entertaining book, and she was gardening in her 90s, and that's why she had to do it, because she couldn't dig up things. And her brother didn't help. He was Rex Stout, and he was a mystery writer. I suppose he was busy on the typewriter. But anyway, this is the second time you've talked about it. That's why I wanted to tell you it works, and it works phenomenally.
Well, there, I just learned something. I didn't know that Rex Stout and Ruth Stout were related.
Yes, yes, as a matter of fact, they were. And there's a whole lot more we're going to talk about here with our guest today, John Hendrickson, as we talk with him about gardening. You can call in at 800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking about the vegetable garden today and about how you might start your own vegetable market gardening business with our guest, John Hendrickson, Senior Outreach Specialist with the Center for Integrated Agricultural Systems at UW-Madison. Sally in Wayland, Minnesota is up next. Hi, Sally.
Hey, Larry. How are you doing today?
Good.
I'm happy to hear that. You were talking about that lady that called about being so amazed about growing potatoes in containers.
Yeah.
Well, that was me, and I wanted to call and offer a little more advice. You guys went on to talk about growing tomatoes then, too. Potatoes, there's a lot of things that can grow well in containers on your deck if you don't have your own soil. I'm a big supporter of community gardens, and if there's anything that people can do to get a community garden going in their community, they should do it.
Sure.
And the kids could do the work from the schools. We could get the kids to do the weeding and the hoeing. Anyhow, on the potatoes, the bigger the container that you have, probably the better, and adding soil to the top of it will increase your yield. I had grown 4 pounds of potatoes in a small, what I consider a small container. It was 12 inches wide by 12 inches deep. I just did it as a lark. It was just an experiment to see what would happen. And in a square foot of soil, I got 4 pounds of potatoes. That's a lot. Can you imagine what you could get if you were actually trying?
Yeah.
And then somebody said they were thinking about growing potatoes in tires. Now, I have never done that myself. And again, I would say it's a worthy experiment. However, the tires, because they're black, they would get really hot. I'm not sure if potatoes like to be hot. I think potatoes like to be cold or cooler. Tomatoes, however, love heat. So I would think tomatoes grown in tires would be really good because, I mean, it can't be too hot for a tomato. I have lots of advice for lots of people, and I would love to help whoever wants help. I wish there was some way that I could. I do run a greenhouse by Whalen, so if anybody wants to stop by, I'll talk to them for sure.
Well,
and you're talking to them now.
Yeah, and you're talking to them right now. Yeah.
The name of my greenhouse is Sustainable Dream Greenhouse, and I'm three miles from Whalen, and I'll help whoever you want. I'm in the Yellow Pages.
Sustainable
Dream.
Dream Greenhouse.
I have a dream.
You do. And you've been very good to call us. Thank you, Sally. Thanks for calling back. Appreciate that very much.
Her comments reminds me of another comment to make to the people interested in growing in containers. So that is two key issues you need to think about there is ensuring that you've got adequate fertility in your container. And the other thing is the containers can dry out extremely fast. And so making sure that, that you're doing adequate watering is really important if you're going to be leaving for any length of time during the summer on a vacation or even just a couple days, a little trip. You need to make sure you either have someone to water those for you or you may be just wise to pull them into the garage, into the shade where they won't go through all the water so quickly on a sunny day.
Bonnie emailed us and asks, can you tell me if a class is available, if the class is available for my son and I? We have maybe about an acre garden and would love to grow veggies to give away to the elderly. Her son is 11 years old. Thanks for any information. So probably that particular course, well, I don't know. Go ahead, John.
You'd certainly learn a lot about how to grow vegetables on your one acre garden,
yeah.
and maximize that. You know, we do have a focus on helping people start a business, but you know, maybe at some point your 11-year-old will be moving in that direction on his own when he's older.
A couple of people were wondering again about the timing and cost associated with it. So give us that information again.
Sure. The class is run in January, and it's run in January because we work with grower instructors, and the grower instructors are obviously too busy to come teach a class during the growing season. So unfortunately, it's when the snow's on the ground, and we don't get to go out and look at plants growing, but we have got lots of pictures that we show. It's January 16th, 17th, and 18th. The first day is 9 to 4:30, Saturday is 8 to 4:30, and then Sunday is 8 to 2, giving people a chance to get home on Sunday night. We have people coming from as far as Nebraska and other states that take this class, but certainly a lot of people from Wisconsin, Northern Illinois that take it. The cost is $275 for the 3 days. That includes snacks and meal, a meal in the middle of the day. And we give each student a big three-ring binder with a host of resources and handouts and publications they can use as they start their business and move forward, as well as the book Sustainable Vegetable Production from Startup to Market, which is an excellent book by Vern Grubinger, who's with the University of Vermont.
So all that. Is there a website people can go to, by the way?
I could spell out the website, but it's a mouthful. So rather people just, if they're online, just Google Wisconsin School for Beginning Market Growers, and they should be able to get there.
Wisconsin School for Beginning Market Growers.
Or just Wisconsin Market Growers. You'll probably find it even with just those few words.
All right. Joe in Gutenberg, Iowa. Your turn now. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Larry. I was just wondering if any of your listeners out there are planting spinach in September and wintering it over till the spring.
Good question. Are you doing that?
I did
that. Yes, I have for years. I planted about the middle of September, and even on a long fall like this one, I had a little bit of a crop before it went dormant. But it lays there all winter. It'll survive sub-zero open temperatures, and in March it starts to grow.
The spinach is a remarkable crop in that regard, and I do that on my market farm, and certainly a lot of other vegetable growers do as well. I don't know how many home gardeners know about that.
Well, when
technique.
Do you plant it?
Well, as you said, in mid-September is a
mid-September.
Good time.
Mid-September.
You know, it's going to vary. You know, obviously, our listening area spans.
Yeah, a pretty broad area.
zone 3 to zone 5, so it would vary depending on where you are. And it also, the other thing to say about that is there are varieties that are better suited to overwintering than others. And so that would be another thing to look for if you're ordering seed in the seed catalogs, to look for varieties that are better at surviving the winter. Winter Bloomsdale is one variety that's excellent for that.
That's Bloomsdale is what I've been planting, and it works great.
Well, that's a good one. Thank you very much, Joe. Yeah, appreciate it.
And the other thing to say about that is that there are also a lot of market growers that are planting spinach around that time in hoop houses or field tunnels. There's lots of different names for these plastic structures that growers use to produce crops on now. And so they're not only they're probably overwintering some outside as well, but they're actually able to harvest spinach through a good part of the winter. Either for themselves or if they have several of these houses, they can grow and supply winter farmers markets, or they can sell it to restaurants or what have you, or give it in their CSA boxes to their CSA members.
Thanks, Joe. Appreciate it very much. And let's go to Larry and Wheeler. Larry, hello to you.
Good morning. I'm enjoying your program. Aren't tomatoes C2 respiration plant? I mean, I just heard someone say, I've been an ardent gardener for 30 years. My father was. I grew up gardening. I have found personally that tomatoes, if I use 5 to 6 inches of mulch and keep the ground cool, I will get 5 to 10 gallons of tomatoes per plant versus getting so much heat to them. Am I wrong on that, or can you get more tomatoes from more heat?
Well, certainly tomatoes are a heat-loving crop, and they're going to do better in warmer temperatures.
But aren't they a C2 respiration where they usually start to shut down the respiratory factors after about 83 degrees?
I can't answer that question.
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
I don't know the answer to that.
I'm not sure about that either. Well, we certainly get higher temperatures than that here in Wisconsin.
But if you keep the ground cooler, and that way the plant actually can take the heat in the sun, but if you keep the ground cooler with a mulch, I have found personally anyway, that they can take the heat and really produce a lot more.
Well, I don't know. I know a lot of growers that have been switching, getting back to the comments I made about growing spinach in hoop houses. Hoop houses is one of the most, well, tomatoes is one of the most common hoop house crops during the summer. And so, you know, the temperatures there are warm and stay warm.
And the ground temperatures would be warm then.
And the ground temperatures would be warm then too. So,
yeah. C2 respiration, you know, like corn's a C1, and you know, it varies on the amount of heat and sunlight they can actually use in their Z-scheme manufacturing.
Yeah. Well, we have let's see, conflicting information on this a little bit, but I thank you very much for calling. Maybe somebody else has a comment on it. Brent in La Crosse, we'll give you a chance. Brent, hello.
Hello. I took John's market gardening class. Five or 10 years.
Oh, could you talk a little louder? I'm sorry.
I took John's class 5 or 6 years ago, and I was on his website yesterday, and I was looking for the cut flower course. Are you going to be offering that? I only found old information.
Yeah, the reason that you only found old information is that we've decided to take the year off on the flower school.
Okay.
We ran it 3 years in a row, and just noticed a little dip in enrollment last year, and decided that maybe that would be a class to offer every other year, also because we've got demand for other schools. And so we're probably going to have a rotation because there's only so many of the programs that we can run during the winter months.
Yeah. So
I apologize that you're out this year, but if you stick around and visit this website next year, you'll find it.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And we have some open lines. We'll get you on pretty fast here at 1-800-642-1234. Of course, you can also email us at talk@wpr.org. Bobby emailed us and said, Bill Wright is heading up an expanded program called Got Dirt out of Brown County, UW Extension. Blue Cross Blue Shield Grant trains the trainers on implementing school gardens. So that's going back to that earlier call. Got Dirt is a statewide gardening initiative to increase access to fruits and vegetables in Wisconsin. So are you familiar with that?
Well, I'm certainly familiar with Bill Wright. He's been doing some excellent work for many years with small-scale farmers and gardeners up in the Green Bay area. So I would highly recommend that the earlier caller get in touch with Bill, because I'm sure that's an excellent program and will really help her out.
And she also mentions there's a regional conference on nutrition and fitness, building a healthier community, Eat Well, Live Well. That's in Chicago coming up next month, a conference in Chicago on nutrition. So thanks for that information, Bobby. Sandra in Madison emails, enjoys gardening. Seems too good to be true that I could actually produce some income from it. How do I know if I would be successful? How much money, space, what kind of soil is necessary to begin market gardening?
Well, there's a host of questions there. I guess it's just to comment on that last question first about what soil is required. Certainly, you're going to be a lot better off with a nice silt loam without too much clay. There's also a lot of vegetables that really do well on sandier soils. So the better soil that you have, the better off you're going to be. But there are market growers making a go of it on virtually all soil types across the state of Wisconsin and across the U.S. So it can be done in a variety of circumstances. In terms of how much
space and so forth,
there are market growers in Wisconsin at an acre or less. There are people that consider themselves market growers that are, 100 acres and everything in between. Kind of depends on what your goals are in terms of the business. If it's going to be a part-time business, obviously the smaller scale can achieve those kinds of goals. If you're thinking about a full-time income for yourself, your family, spouse, kids, what have you, we're obviously talking about the larger end of the spectrum. Kind of the smallest scale that I've seen work for a household, a family, is kind of in the 5-acre scale range. Maybe 4 to 6 acres is possible.
That is
certainly helps if you're. It certainly helps if you've already owned your land and you don't have a mortgage.
Yeah.
At that scale.
But you could get in with an acre.
Yes, you can certainly begin with. I would recommend actually beginning with less than an acre if you don't have a tremendous experience growing and marketing fresh vegetables. Because you can grow a lot of food when you're talking about vegetables. You can grow a lot of food on and not very much space.
That's very true. And so, Sandra, you might want to consider this course, 16th, 17th, and 18th in January. And just go online to Wisconsin School for Beginning Market Growers. Can you register online for that? Or
we are not set up to register online, but you can download our brochure that has the registration form on it and then mail it in.
Okay. Very good. Jan in Superior is up next. Jan, hello to you.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm at work, and I'm listening to your program here. And
we won't tell.
I just have a comment regarding the temperature of soil being cold when you were growing tomatoes. You had a caller that called in. And I had an experience a number of years ago. I used to grow all of our produce, and I have a septic tank, concrete top, and it is just below the surface, and because we didn't have a basement. So I only had maybe 8 inches of soil on top of that septic tank. I planted tomatoes on top of the septic tank because it is very chilly up here, and it takes a long time for that soil in the ground to really warm up. But I had to mulch them and keep them watered well. My biggest problem was to get stakes in because these tomatoes were 6 feet tall. That's how they grew, and I had tomatoes that were as big as 2 pounds. I just had a fantastic crop of tomatoes. I also planted one package of cucumbers, and there weren't very many seeds in that, and I had 120 pounds of cucumbers. So that was utilizing the heat coming off of the septic tank.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, that just goes along with what I was saying, or at least what my experience is with tomatoes. And another comment that I'd make about the tomatoes and the heat issue is that there are a lot of vegetable growers that put down plastic mulch. It's a very common practice, particularly in organic production, to put down black plastic mulch, and then they poke holes in the put your tomato transplants in there, and that's certainly raising the soil temperatures significantly.
Makes sense. Thank you very much. Appreciate the call, Jan. Someone wondered, Sandra wondered, if you know of anyone who uses horses to do market gardening, like in the journal Small Farmers Journal.
Well, I do, and certainly all of the Amish vegetable growers in our state, of which there are very many, are using horses to produce vegetables. But there are a growing, I don't know how many there are, so I guess I can't say there's a growing number, but I do know of a few vegetable growers that are non-Amish vegetable growers that are using horses up in the northern part of the state, and also another farm near Baraboo. So it can be done.
They're out there. Tracy in La Crosse, on to you now. Hi, Tracy.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me on the air here.
Sure.
I was just curious as to how much capital would be required if you had, say, 2 acres of land, whatnot, to raise some vegetables on.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is going to depend on some factors. It might depend on how old you are and how much work you're going to do by hand and how much you're willing to do by hand. Or if you're older and the roof stout phase of your life, you may do things a lot differently, maybe do things on a smaller scale. I did a study a little while ago of vegetable farms, and the scales of farms ranged throughout the study from very small, less than an acre farms to farms that were over 100 acres of vegetables. And there was a wide range of, you know, how much capital those farms had invested. But by and large, we saw a somewhat similar average across the different scales of farms of having about $10,000 in equipment per acre in production. Now, certainly a lot of these farms have been in business for quite a while. And so, you know, they didn't invest all of that all at once.
Yeah, sure.
It happens over time. You know, you get pieces of equipment here and there. And there's ways to do it for not very much money. You know, you can go to farm auctions and get equipment, used equipment, inexpensively. The caution there is that you got to know what you're looking for and what you're looking at, and evaluating used equipment is something that, if you didn't grow up on a farm, is no small notion. And there's a growing amount of equipment that's more geared towards smaller scale production too, which has been pleasing to see over the last few years, from different types of seeders that are available, to carts that can help you in terms of having better ergonomic situations in the market garden, so you're scooting yourself along on a cart as opposed to being stooped over. And certainly the walk-behind rototiller is a godsend to a smaller-scale vegetable producer.
Yep.
That's one of the things we do focus on in the school. We do ask our grower instructors to bring some of their favorite tools and equipment, the smaller scale equipment, actually into the classroom for show and tell. And so it's a great opportunity for our beginning growers to see what growers are using.
All right. Thanks a lot. Yeah.
Yep.
Thanks for calling, Tracy. Appreciate it. John Henriksen, our guest today, as we talk with him about producing food for your household from your garden and about the Wisconsin School for Beginning Market Growers. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking vegetable gardening today with John Henriksen. John, relating to having your own business, your own market garden, we've got Chad in Milwaukee with an email, wonders, in addition to stretching budgets, vegetable gardening could be a means of self-employment. What is a good blend of crops to minimize risk? I understand there's a premium on certain hard-to-grow vegetables.
That's a great question. Certainly, a diversified approach is going to reduce your risk. Any vegetable grower will tell you that in a given year, some crops will do well and some won't do so well. You may have a weather incident that severely impacts a crop, or a pest issue that severely impacts a crop. And if you're diversified, the impact of not having that crop to sell will be less if you're diversified. The flip side of that is that growing lots of vegetables is extremely demanding in terms of being able to do all those things well, and just a matter of time in terms of all the planting and crop maintenance and harvest. Certainly, if you're selling at a farmer's market or doing community-supported agriculture, filling boxes for CSA members, you need to be highly diversified is the general recommendation, so that you have either a nice, full, diverse box to give to your CSA members, or at your farmer's market stand, you have lots of different choices and lots of different colors and things to attract people to your stand, and also lots of different things for them to buy, so they can not just come and buy one thing from you, but spend spend additional money while they're at your stand. So a lot of the vegetable growers that I work with in my work with the university are growing 40, 50 different distinct types of vegetable crops, and then of course within that they're growing many, many different varieties of those different vegetables. So can the list of varieties that a grower might grow is over 100 or 200 in some cases, in terms of all the different varieties that they might be growing, all kinds of different lettuce varieties, reds,
and
greens.
What size garden are we talking about there with that many varieties?
Oh, even at the acre level, he might be growing a lot of different crops.
Catherine and Madison, your turn now. Hi, Catherine.
Hi there. How are you guys doing today?
Good.
Good. Quick question, and I'll take my answer off the air. I'm thinking about trying to grow something this over the winter here, and I, of course, have to do it up in the house. So I'm just wondering, what could I possibly grow, how I would go about it? I guess that's more than one question, how I would go about it. And I guess that's the two questions. What could I grow, and how could I go about it?
All right.
Okay, so that you're thinking about growing in the house in the winter.
Yeah, I was trying to grow up some stuff this winter.
Okay.
Well,
it's difficult to do it in the winter in the house because of low light conditions. I mean, you're going to be dealing with low light conditions in the house anyway, unless you're using some artificial light. And one comment to make there is that you don't need to go out and buy the more expensive grow lights that are specifically geared towards plants. If you get some inexpensive shop lights and use both a cool and a warm light bulb in an inexpensive shop light, you'll cover the spectrum of light that the plants need, and do that more inexpensively than buying the expensive grow lights that are available. In terms of in the house winter production, I think I might just focus on growing some herbs.
Mm-hmm.
Quite frankly, just in terms of the space. My guess is that you don't want to take over your whole house with growing plants, and in terms of getting the most out of the small space and the limited light, I would you can grow some nice basil and have some nice cooking herbs to use in your kitchen.
Yeah, and when you're using those lights, by the way, how close do those lights have to be to really get good?
Well, the recommendation there is the lights need to be very close to the plants. If you're sprouting the seed, you basically want those lights almost on top of where the soil is, because you're dealing with a low light situation. If you don't have the lights very, very close to the plants are going to get leggy, and you don't want a leggy little plant. It's just not going to get off to a good start.
Let's go to Michelle in Dodgeville next. Michelle, hello to you.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call this morning.
Sure.
I have yet another question on growing greens in the winter.
Okay.
I am kind of a large scale home gardener. I have a high tunnel or hoop house that I grow greens in. A friend recently mentioned that there is a threat of growing greens in low light and nitrates or nitrite absorption into especially spinach. And I'm just wondering what you might know about that, and if I am growing greens through the winter, should I be adding supplemental light? Obviously they're not growing much right now, but even through those later months, September, October, is there a threat of too much, that we're eating too much nitrates in our spinach?
That is an issue with growing greens in the wintertime, and particularly with spinach. My understanding of that is that the nitrate levels in the spinach can really fluctuate dramatically. So if you are harvesting on or after a sunny day, then the risk is greatly reduced. So what I would suggest to you is, if you have a long, very gray spell, of course we are prone to those in Wisconsin in the wintertime, that you may not want to do too much harvesting and eating from your plot. Now, if you were eating that, every day for all your meals, it would obviously be a bigger issue than, just an occasional salad too. So.
Right. Great. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. For the woman who called two calls ago, who wondered about growing something in the house, someone else phoned in or emailed in and said she should grow sprouts.
Jars. I thought of that. I thought of that too, and just didn't get around to mentioning it. Yep.
And I've grown sprouts in it, and they're fun and they're tasty.
And the other thing to say about sprouts is that, you know, traditionally when we think about sprouts, we think about alfalfa sprouts, but you can sprout
anything.
All kinds of different things. Sunflower sprouts and all the different brassica crops. Broccoli sprouts are extremely nutritious. And, you know, some of the red kales, you can get different colors. And you can make a whole salad out of, you know, all kinds of different little baby sprouts.
Yeah, that's a very good idea. And someone else wondered about your attention to seed catalogs. Which seed catalogs do you pay close attention to?
Well, as a certified organic grower, I tend to lean towards the catalogs that offer me certified organic seed. I typically will order from a number of different catalogs so that I spread my business around. I like to support a number of different companies with my seed consumer dollar, so to speak. I order from Johnny Selected Seeds, and I will order from Seeds of Change and High Mowing Seeds, Fedco.
Mm-hmm.
There's
four right there.
There's four right there. But, you know, the seed catalogs are coming in the mailboxes right now, and it's a great time of year to be a vegetable grower because everything's perfect
everything
right now.
Looks great.
Everything looks great, and you have this vision in your head of what your garden or your farm is going to look like next year. So,
Carl in Darlington, we're on to you now. Hi, Carl.
Hi. The only comment I got is some of the things that I've raised and the tomatoes I've raised, and I use a red base underneath, and that is supposed to up the production of the tomato itself. And my brother just happened to have an old carpet he was throwing out, and it happened to be red, and it worked very well this year. I punched a hole in it and put the tomatoes in there, and that was a good tomato crop. And also, another comment would be on radishes in the fall, like that one gentleman was planting spinach in September. Radishes work wonderful that way. Just in the spring, you got to remember to buy enough seeds for September, and you have the best radish crop you've ever had. Also, a comment on potatoes on the ground, which work very well with a mulch, and I should get even better than that. But that will be next year. I've got approximately about an acre that I want to be an icon in the garden business.
Right. Well,
someday I might get there.
Well, sure. You guys got to keep at it. Thanks.
I enjoy the seed catalogs, but how to get them coming to my mailbox is another question. I wonder how a guy could get all of them rather than having to do business with them in the past. You know, then they'll send you one. Any
thoughts on that? Yeah.
Well, I guess if you have access to the internet, it's a great way to, you know, a lot of the catalogs are even online these days. But, you know, most of them have a way to request catalogs. So if you
can go online.
If you can go online either at your home or at your community library, and search for seed companies, you'll get a very, very long list of companies. A quick comment about the red mulch for tomatoes. That is true that red has been shown to increase production of tomatoes. There are growers, I mentioned the plastic mulch that growers use, and typically it's black, but there is red plastic mulch that growers use. I personally would be a little careful about using used carpeting, given the chemicals that are mm-hmm. used in the manufacture of carpeting.
So that's an issue. But why red? Why would red be? Why not, I suppose?
There's been research done with using all different colors across the spectrum to determine if there are influence of the different colors on increasing yields. There's also been research done to see if any of those mulches will detract or confuse insect pests, too. And there's been some suggestion that some of the silver, you know, more reflective mulches provide a little bit of help with confusing insects.
Well, John, tell us again now as we wind up the show here. The Wisconsin School for Beginning Market Growers is Friday through Sunday, January 16th, 17th, and 18th, correct?
That is correct, and we run it about that time, same time every year.
And so the cost on that is $275.
It's $275.
Okay. And people, how do people sign up?
Well, they can contact me, and I can help them out. My work number is 608-265-3704. If they get online and search for Wisconsin School for Beginning Market Growers or just Wisconsin Market Growers, they'll probably be able to quickly click to our website, and you can download the brochure there. I can also, my email message, my email address is jhendric@wisc.edu. And if you send me an email message, I can send you the brochure as an attachment.
John, thank you very much. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Larry.
Appreciate it very much. John Hendrickson, Senior Outreach Specialist with the Center for Integrated Agricultural Systems, as he talked with us about vegetables. Well, coming up, we're going to take a look at some mysteries of the plant kingdom. Ken Drews has a new book out. It's called Plantthropology, The Myths, Mysteries, and Miracles of My Garden Favorites. And it's a fascinating read. So we're looking forward to visiting with him next year on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at some of the mysteries of the plant kingdom now as we visit with Ken Drews. Larry Mueller here. Ken Drews gardens in New Jersey, is the author of many award-winning books, including The Natural Garden and Ken Drews, The Passion for Gardening, and his newest book, beautiful book. It's called Plantthropology, The Myths, Mysteries, and Miracles of My Garden Favorites. It's published by Clarkson Potter. I'm really pleased to have him with us today to talk about his book and to certainly answer your questions. So we're kind of going from vegetables to flowers here now, with Ken's more a flower guy than a vegetable guy. So think in terms of flowers and think in terms of mysteries associated with them as we visit with him. You can join us, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Ken Drews, welcome back. Nice to have you with us.
Hi, it's so nice to be here.
I tell you what, this is a beautiful book. There's not only is there some breathtaking photography in this book, you've got history, you've got biology, economics.
Mysteries, miracles, myths. I try to cover it all.
How did you happen to come to write this book?
Well, I think one of the main reasons is I'd like people to think of plants more seriously and to therefore think of the world and the earth and conservation more seriously. And I know that when people come to visit my own garden who are not gardeners, they kind of see the whole thing as one big green mess. But when I start telling them about some of the remarkable stories, and there's stories behind every single plant, plants that started wars, plants that can help cure cancer, you tell them the stories and the plants become individuals. And that's one of the great secrets to gardening, and I hope it's going to help people take care of the earth too.
Yeah, and you've got some wonderful stories, and just out of your own garden, my goodness. I was kind of amazed as I was reading through the book, and I have to tell you, I didn't finish the book yet, but I certainly plan to do it. One of the interesting characters you talk about in the book, people, was Sir Joseph Banks.
Mm-hmm.
And he was an interesting guy.
Well, he was one of the early plant explorers, and he went with Captain Cook to discover what they thought was going to be called Banksia, but it ended up being Australia. And a lot of people have heard of Mutiny on the Bounty or seen the movie, and they don't really realize that whole trip of the Bounty was to get breadfruit, and Banks backed that trip. He paid for it himself. So we think of Mutiny on the Bounty and the story, but we don't realize that the point of that was to get plants. Because in those days, searching for new plants, especially in the days before refrigeration, plants and spices and herbs, those were as good as gold. They were worth their weight in gold, and some of them still are.
Yeah, some of them still, they certainly are. And I'm going to ask you about those, but just for our listeners, tell us how you've organized your book. And by the way, Plantthropology, did you come up with that name?
Yeah, that's a made-up word.
It's a cool word, I love it.
Anthropology with a PL in front of it.
I love it.
Oh, I'm glad, and I'm glad you can say it. I hope more people can say it, too. Planthropology. I think it's easy to say. In the book, there's explorers like Banks, people who risk their lives to find new plants. There's a chapter on scent and how scent triggers memory. Scent and memory in our brains are right next to each other, which is why sometimes you smell something and remember your grandmother. There's a chapter on medicinal plants. There's a part on poison. There's a chapter on mathematics and geometry, and I didn't know anything about that when I started, except I noticed there were things in plants, especially like the seed head of a sunflower. There were these spirals of seeds, and why? So I went to find out, and I share that in the book.
And the photography in the book is really stunning.
Oh, thank you so much.
Did you do the photography, some of it yourself?
Or? I did all but about six pictures. There's 450 pictures in the book.
I'm telling you, it really, really, really is stunning. Well, I tell you what, let's answer a few questions. And by the way, maybe you've got a question about plants. Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. You've got so many interesting little things in your book, stories that relate to plants.
Mm-hmm.
There was a war fought over a plant?
There's actually been more than one war fought over plants. There were the Nutmeg Wars. I don't think anyone knows about the Nutmeg Wars, but the Dutch found nutmeg on one island, and they eventually fought with the natives of the island and wiped them out. But probably the best known or most famous wars fought over a plant were for the opium poppy.
Yeah.
And the British at the time in the 1830s and 40s were the largest drug cartel in the world. And they introduced opium to the Chinese, and finally one out of every four adult males in China were addicted to opium. And the Chinese tried to stop the British, and they had two wars, and they were not too successful against the greatest navy in the world.
Yeah, it's amazing a story. Another led to the collapse of a European superpower, another plant.
Yes, that's the tulip. And at one time, the tulip, in Holland, the entire stock market was not based on gold or on dollars, or guilders. It was based on the tulip. And people traded tulip futures because the tulips were incredible at the time. They had remarkable variegations and stripes, which we know now were caused by a virus. So these plants were not very stable, and they were selling plants for what would be the equal of a mansion in downtown Amsterdam. And finally, the stock market collapsed and the economy collapsed.
What are you talking about the value of plants? What is the most valuable blossom
today
in the world? Yeah,
I think actually that probably the crocus, Crocus sativa, which is the source of
saffron,
right? The I guess it's an herb. I was thinking spice herb, but maybe it's a spice. Mm. But that's the anthers of a crocus that actually you could probably grow in Wisconsin with a lot of care, but you won't make your money on it. But they do farm it, and it's about equal to the value of gold per pound.
That's absolutely amazing. Well, talk a little bit more about scent. You cover a lot in your book, but tell us a bit more about scent and us humans.
Well, fragrance is just, I'm just wild for it. And I go from plant to plant, and usually we kind of smell things the same, but there are certain plants like the calycanthus, the spice bush. Some people think it smells like bubblegum. Some people think it smells like whiskey barrels. It smells different to everyone. But when I try to describe scents, there's very few words for fragrance. People say sweet. Something smells sweet, but sugar doesn't have a fragrance.
No.
So it's kind of weird. It's hard to describe. And it's also fun to try to say, well, a lily kind of smells like clove, maybe a little wintergreen. But scent and memory, as I mentioned, are very close to each other in our brains. And when I smell certain plants, especially lilies, I just, or lilacs, my goodness.
Lilacs, yes.
I smell lilacs, and I think of my mother, and I'm taken back to a Mother's Day when they usually bloom many, many years ago. Just one sniff and I'm back.
I wish you could come to Wisconsin sometime about that time of the year and visit our University of Wisconsin Arboretum.
Mm-hmm.
because there are many, many, many lilacs, hundreds of lilac trees, and it's they have thousands and thousands of people come Mother's Day time to just, I like just to go over there and wander.
Breathe.
I mean,
and inhale, right? And the colors.
Yes.
And the great thing about lilacs, too, is that deer don't eat them.
Yeah, deer don't eat them. That's right. Well, another plant that I saw as I was paging through the book, I stopped because it was another plant that brought scent to mind to me. And I'm trying to remember the Latin name, but it's essentially tobacco plants.
Mm-hmm.
Those are lovely plants. Not the tobacco we smoke, but talk about those plants a little.
Well, that's Nicotiana.
Nicotiana, that's right.
And the tobacco that people smoke is very similar to the ones that we grow. They bloom. You know, you see the flowers on them. Sometimes they're small. Sometimes they're a little bit larger. But they're very fragrant, mostly in the evening and into the night, because they're night pollinated. They're pollinated by moths. So that's an interesting thing about a lot of plants, even a related plant, which are the petunias. You may not notice that a petunia has a fragrance, but check it out at 5 o'clock at night, and you'll realize that it does. It has a very strong clove and, again, wintergreen fragrance. And a lot of those plants that are like that, especially white-flowered plants, they attract moths to see them at night. Some plants are even bat-pollinated. Nicotianas are great, but don't eat them.
No, don't eat them.
Don't eat them.
But they are wonderful, and frankly, I guess I like them because in evening, as evening approached, and just to go outside and sit on the deck or the patio, and have that aroma suddenly, that scent suddenly come to your nose. Mm. It's a wonderful, a wonderful experience. And you actually propagate those somehow. You talk about that a little bit in your book, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, well, if you've grown Nicotiana, and many people have, of course, and even in Wisconsin, maybe one or two plants might come up from a seed that managed to live through the winter, and you'll notice that it's not the color that you may have planted. And over time, the Nicotiana hybrids will revert to one that's kind of a mauve color, kind of a dull color. But I like brown flowers. I like tan flowers. So year after year, I've been selecting the plants that have the darkest flowers and saving the seeds from those and sowing those. And I've gotten pretty close. I'm about to brown sugar now, I think. Maybe I'm close to tobacco in color. That's a good idea. I need a name for that plant.
You need a name for it. You have an early memory in your book of a walk with your mother in the woods. And that particular walk sort of set your love toward flowers, did it not?
I suppose it did. Towards flowers, definitely. Well, maybe my fascination with plants, with growing plants and their leaves and their flowers and their forms and the thrill of nurturing a plant. To me, it's so exciting. I don't know why. Everyone doesn't feel that way, but I'm sure that your listeners do. But yes, we just happened across a Jack in the Pulpit in the woods, and she told me the name, and I'm sure I didn't even know what she was talking about, a pulpit, a jack. But she lifted up that hood, if you've ever seen them, and there was a little jack inside. And, you know, really, that was it. If you did that with kids today, I think they wouldn't be throwing themselves at the video games. You know, if you take a kid outside before he or she's 3 or 4 years old and just show them some of the wonderful things that are outdoors, what's more fascinating than that?
Yeah, you actually write about that, too. I think you were in England and so watching some third graders outside.
No, that was in Massachusetts.
Oh, Massachusetts. I'm sorry. In New England.
Yeah, New England. I go to some public gardens around the country, and a lot of them have children's gardens now, and that usually means that there's a lot of plastic and bright colors, and kids like it, but you don't need that. And I was just watching some kids take a tour, and they were having a discussion on which tree was which based on the shape of the leaf, and they were comparing them all by themselves, just having this wonderful almost debate. And I thought, this is the way to do it. You don't need those plastic slides and little cottages with gnomes. Just show them nature.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there are so many things I can talk with you about here. The one thing it has to do with the signatures on the Declaration of Independence, and even older documents are still readable today. What was the partnership between insects and trees to create such long-lasting ink?
Had you ever heard of that?
No.
I was surprised. Well, ink for many, many, many years, until pretty recently, was made from oak trees, but it was actually made from the galls on oak trees, because there's different kinds of wasps that will inject an egg into the tissue of an oak tree. It doesn't harm the tree, either the leaves or the stems, and they grow these growths, which we call galls, and the galls were harvested because they had a lot of tannin from the oak trees, and they were mixed with different things like iron oxide and actually human urine, and they made ink out of it. It was brown when it went on the paper, or actually on the parchment, and then it turned black over time, and even the Declaration of Independence was made with oak gall ink, with oak gall ink.
That's an amazing story, and you... Why don't these stories get? Why aren't these stories told more often?
I don't know. I'm doing my best.
You sure are. Well, you talk about your own garden, and you've kind of a delightful segment there where you're talking about walking around your garden and looking at each individual plant. Tell us about your garden, by the way.
Well, my garden is an island in a river, which sounds so romantic, but you can't tell it's an island, really, except today, actually, it might flood, so then we'll know it's an island, but you get to the island on one-lane bridge, and you get off it on another one-lane bridge, and I don't think the drivers even realize it. They probably just think it's inconvenient because they have to wait and be patient, but it's an island in a river in the northwest corner of New Jersey, so it's very exciting because it does flood from time to time. And it's odd. It's a quirky piece of land. It's about 2.6 acres, and about an acre and a half is garden. But I could use a little more sun, I think. And I have weeds, and I have deer, and we have bear. But I'm mostly growing as many different things as I possibly can and trying to make it look good, too, which can be done. So it's a zoo of plants, which is what we call a botanical garden, but it's just a garden. It's my garden.
And these are basically the kinds of plants you talk about in your book. There are some exotic plants, certainly, in your book, but you talk about the plants that you love.
Yes, I talk about the plants that I love, and I talk about the plants that fit in the book, because, as I said, every plant has a story. It's really incredible. Every plant has a story that I can come across. And so many of the plants that are in the book and the plants that I grow are plants that are very familiar to everyone. I mean, tulips, everybody knows about tulips and Nicotiana and poppies and oak trees. So these are not really you might imagine that if we went to Madagascar, we'd find some really fantastic stories about some unusual plants we could never grow. But these are plants in the garden. Plants in our gardens have incredible stories, too.
What is the divine proportion, and how does it show up in nature? You talk about that in your book.
Well, that's a tough one to talk about on the radio. It's even hard to talk about in the book. But there, you may have heard of the Fibonacci numbers, and maybe you haven't, but I'll try to do this. If you take 0 and 1, add them together, you have 1. And if you take 1 and 1 and add it together, you have 2. And if you have take 2 and 1 and add it together, you have 3. And if you take 3 and 2 and add it together, you have 5. And this is a sequence of numbers. And the ratio between one number and the second number is 1 to 1.618. Got that?
Mm-hmm.
And that ratio shows up everywhere. It shows up in plants. It's the angle of the leaves around the stem of a plant. It's the relationship of seeds on a sunflower seed head. There's arcs in one direction with a number of seeds and arcs in another direction a number of seeds, and those ratios are, again, 1 to 1.618. And on a pine cone, if you ever look at the spirals on a pine cone, again, the scales on the pine cone have that same ratio. And that ratio was used, it's called the golden mean sometimes, or the golden section. It's been used in art for thousands and thousands of years, kind of coincidentally. And I know there's an ancient Roman thing that I came across that said if you find a partner, a potential partner, who's the distance between the person's navel and the top of his head and the navel and the ground, if the ratio is 1 to 1.618, that will make a good partner for marriage. It's amazing. And that evolves into a spiral, the spiral of the chambered nautilus, and even the spiral of the stars and the Milky Way. They're all the same ratio. And these things were, the original ratio was discovered in the 1400s and 1500s, and Leonardo da Vinci imagined that the spiral of leaves around a stem were so that every leaf would get rain from above and get sunlight from above. Because if you ever look straight down on the stem, the leaves are notching around the stem in a spiral.
Yeah.
And from the top first leaf until you reach the next leaf that's directly below it, the number of turns in relationship to the number of leaves is 1 to 1.618. Amazing.
It's amazing. And you illustrate it well in your book with the wonderful photography that you have.
Thank you. That was one of the biggest challenges, try to communicate that. But I'm glad you think that I did. I show people how to make the spiral and how to figure out and show them, as you said, the illustration of these different relationships.
Well, I tell you, it's a lovely book you have here. And you talk about the fact that, let's see, how shall I put this? You talk about your favorite flowers. I was going to ask you what your favorite flower was, but then I read what you said in the book. But I'll ask it anyway, because I think it was a good answer that you gave.
Well, today I'd say it's the next one I meet that I don't have. Sometimes it's the one that I'm looking at until I turn my head and look at another one. People do ask me that question, and I don't think I have a favorite flower. It's like almost asking, you know, which of your children is your favorite. Even if you know, don't tell. Keep it to yourself. But I don't know. There's so many new plants I meet all the time. I have favorites, I'd say, but I don't have a favorite.
Have you ever visited Wisconsin for pleasure or for tour?
Yes,
lecturing?
And I've been to Madison and seen the prairies there at the university.
Oh, so you have
Curtis Prairie.
So you have been to the Arboretum.
Mm-hmm.
So we have some wonderful plants and plant settings here in Wisconsin, certainly in Madison. Well, I'm glad that you made that trip. For those who thinking about your book, Plantthropology, what do you tell them? Why should they buy this book?
Well, it would make a lovely gift for the holidays. That's for sure.
Yeah, that's for sure.
If you love plants, I think that you'll love this book. And if you have a friend who loves plants, it's a great gift. And even more, if you have a friend who doesn't get it yet, I think that there's enough sensational things in the book, exciting, unusual facts. Anybody who likes that kind of, I hate to say trivia, but the kind of trivial facts, it's a great pursuit. You know, it'll be a lot of fun, and the pictures are wonderful.
Oh, yeah.
And as I said, it's to help people take another look. And we're always attracted to things like the spotted owl. You know, if it's got two eyes, we pay attention to it, and then we can save the redwoods. But with plants, they don't have eyes, and they don't move around quite so fast. So I'm hoping that some of these stories will get people to care more about plants and more about the earth.
Thank you, Ken, very much. Appreciate it.
Larry, it's been great to talk to you. I want people to visit my website if they can for more information, kendruse.com.
D-R-U-S-E.
Right, kendruse.com. And just have a wonderful winter and a wonderful spring.
Thank you very much. Ken Drews, author of the book Plantthropology. I tell you what, it is a wonderful book. Plantthropology, The Myths, Mysteries, and Miracles of My Garden Favorites. Pleasure to have him with us, and we'll probably have him back again another time for another topic. Monday, we'll talk personal fitness with Dustin Maher and also Apple computers. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.